today. Let's go ahead and get started. Carla, are you on?
I am, Mayor. Good morning.
Good morning. All right. Good morning, everybody. This is the Wednesday, April 29th, 2020 session of the Portland City Council. It's, of course, a virtual council hearing. So first of all, Carla, if you could call the roll just so I don't forget.
Mm-hmm. Hardesty?
Here.
Udaly?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Wheeler?
Here. All right. We're all here. Under Portland City Code and state law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members of council are attending remotely by phone, and the city has made several avenues available for the public to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. The public can also provide written testimony to council by emailing the council clerk at cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. That's cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. The council is taking these steps as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to limit in-person contact and promote physical distancing. The pandemic is an emergency that threatens the public health, safety, and welfare, which requires us to meet remotely by electronic communications. Thank you all for your patience, flexibility, and understanding as we manage through this difficult situation to do the city's business. With that, Carla, first up is communications. And I'm told we have to read each of the communications slots, even if individuals are not present. So if we could start with 3, 2, 1, please.
Did you want the city attorney's opening statement?
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot that. Lindley, Lindley, you're the attorney this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
To participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or the first readings of ordinances. The published council agenda at portlandoregon.gov/auditor contains information about how and when you may sign up for testimony while the council is holding electronic meetings. Your testimony should address the matter being considered at the time. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you are a lobbyist. If you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When your time is up, the presiding officer will ask you to conclude. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being placed on hold or ejected from the remainder of the electronic meeting. Please be aware that all council meetings are recorded. Thank you.
Very good. And with that, Carla, item 3-2-1, communications, please.
Request of Dan Gregorio to address council regarding sidewalks. He will not be speaking today.
All right, thank you. Mm-hmm. Next item, please, sorry.
3-22, request of John Carter to address council regarding challenges securing a crisis.
Is Mr. Carter with us?
I am.
I believe he is.
Okay. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well. Thank you.
Okay, fantastic. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. We are in unprecedented times in which the social and economic conditions of the city have been shaken in a flash. I believe it's important to recognize, though, that the virus has accelerated an economic trend that was already well in motion, a relentlessly increasing cost barrier to live and participate in the city. How can it be claimed that we are moving towards an equity lens when the baseline to contribute to the fabric has been raised well beyond reach? In my experience in looking for a space to open our business, I saw plentiful commercial vacancies, but highly restrictive pricing and fee costs, such as triple net terms. Spaces remain vacant for months or years. Spaces that could be immediately ignited for productive use, needed community resources, and social connection. The city's urban landscape has beautiful bones, but so much of it has been hollowed out for the sake of profit potential. Why do these spaces remain vacant for so long? I see many factors at play, but I'd say speculative thinking is a leading cause. An owner-developer would rather keep a space vacant and write the loss of revenue off to nab a highly profitable future tenant, usually a deep-pocketed chain or boutique targeted to niche wealth. when profit potential shapes the city and becomes the end rather than a means to creating something of value and community connection, it warps who the city is for. We call it market rate, but when the market is only open to those positioned for high profit, shouldn't we question how the gate is measured and for who it is open? Many of Portland's businesses are in a moment of crisis. Those positioned for efficient profit may survive. Many will sadly perish. The stage has been set for a massive reset. We need to put the conditions in place that refocus and reaffirm our city's penchant for localism. We need to open up opportunities for all Portlanders to build and contribute to our city's landscape, particularly racially and economically disadvantaged people that have been shut out in the past and will continue to be so within the confines of the current schema. Here are some suggestions to increase commercial equity and opportunity. Vacancy tax. Impose meaningful monthly penalties on owners and developers that opt to keep a space vacant for speculative purposes rather than lower the rental rate to widen the opportunity pool. Decrease permit fees and complexity for small businesses. Grant incentive for businesses that offer direct community benefit. Moratorium on corporate chains establishing new business within city limits unless they are employee-owned. Tax and grant incentives for local businesses that operate under an equity ownership model. The house is not a home without the people to shape it. The market is an ever-heightening gate for access. And even if you make it, how to pay for the cost of participation is top of mind. If we are to have a dynamic, vibrant, equitable Portland, we need to fundamentally shift the rules of the game. I thank you very much for your time and all the work that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Carter, for your testimony. We appreciate it. And we know you had to jump through a few extra hoops to get here to present this today. But you did an outstanding job, and we thank you very much for your participation. We hope to hear from you again soon.
Thank you, Mayor.
You bet. Thank you. Carla, next individual is item 323. If you could read that, please.
Request of Elijah Cetus to address council regarding Zenith Energy.
Mr. Cetus, are you on board today?
Yeah, greetings. Greetings, commissioners.
Greetings.
My name is Elijah Cetus. I'm an organizer with Center for Sustainable Economy. I also grew up in North Portland. I want to begin by saying thank you for your leadership you all have shown throughout this crisis, and thanks especially to Commissioner Udaly for your bold vision with the Slow Streets, Safe Streets program. There's no going back to normal because we're facing a crisis within crises. On Earth Day, while thousands of youth were digitally gathering to call for climate action, the Portland Tribune reported that the Zenith Oil Terminal was moving ahead with its expansion plans. They've already begun construction at their facility, this despite the Office of Community Technology denying them the required permit. In the midst of a global pandemic and an oil market crash, while we remain sheltered in place, Zenith continues to load crude oil onto ships that are now anchored offshore from California refineries. In a Superfund site and on soils that will liquefy in an earthquake, Zenith proposes to build new pipes and rail racks to bring in ships carrying a toxic chemical called MDI, which is derived from fossil fuels and which causes acute respiratory injury in workers. A recent Harvard study found that 1 micron increase in long-term exposure to fine particulate matter, like diesel emissions, is associated with a 15% increase in COVID-19 mortality rate. So that's a 15% higher death rate from this virus for someone living in Linton or St. John's and along the rail lines exposed to particulate emissions. This pandemic has demonstrated that there are no jobs without healthy communities, and Zenith is putting our community at grave risk. We urge you to bring Zenith to a public hearing so that they can answer to the community. And 2, we urge you to hold the facility to the standards of a new land use compatibility statement that reflects our 2035 comprehensive plan. They should not get an air permit before that. 3, we urge you to develop a fossil fuel risk bonding requirement for the Zenith facility to ensure that the company posts a bond with the city equivalent to the full cost of the risks that are now externalized on the public. But 4, and much more broadly, we urge you to lead on a just recovery from this pandemic, using funds from the federal stimulus and new municipal bonding opportunities to reinvest in a transition to a renewable, caring economy. A just recovery fund for workers impacted by the pandemic and the economic crash could assist people like the 129 employees recently laid off at Greenbrier's freight train manufacturing facility, or the undocumented workers who do not receive federal stimulus checks. The fund could put people to work building seismic retrofits, putting in place an industrial fire brigade in the CEI hub, outfitting low-income and unhoused communities with personal hygiene facilities and solar charging stations. And we should follow Burlington, Vermont's lead and directly invest in weatherization and energy efficiency upgrades for low-income residents and small businesses closed due to the virus. This framework could become a model for a broader reinvestment in the CEI hub and be supplemented from funds from the work now underway to operationalize fossil fuel risk bonds in Portland, starting with the Zenith facility. Portland Harbor needs a just transition, and the city can facilitate that process right now with skills training, job placement, ensuring community benefits,
time is up,
and collective bargaining. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Elijah. And we have a couple more people who want to comment, or at least one other individual who wants to comment on Zenith. And after that, I just have a few brief comments in response to your great testimony. Next individual, please, Carla, is item 324.
Request of Eileen Frommer to address council regarding Zenith Energy.
Good morning. Eileen, are you with us today?
Thank you. I had to unmute. I'm here.
No worries.
Thank you, Mayor Wheeler, Commissioners Fritz, Hugh Daly, and Harvesty. I'm Eileen Frommer. I'm a third-generation Portlander and owner of both commercial and residential property in Portland. I have been active in efforts to harness fossil fuels for the past 6 years, including the ban on new large fossil fuel infrastructures. I'm also a member of 350 PDX and more recently the Stop Zenith Collaborative. I am aware that Zenith has applied for several new permits to add pipes, pumps, and new rail car unloading platforms. However, I'm here specifically to speak about their request for a long overdue air quality permit. This request for an air quality permit gives the city an opportunity to question the legality of their operation of importing crude oil and using our air, land, and water to transfer crude oil and send it out of state as well as overseas. First, our opportunity is to inform DEQ that a new land use compatibility statement is a legal right required in order to issue any new or revised Title V air quality permit without the city's approval of land use. The last time the city issued a land use compatibility statement for the address at which Zenith operates was in 1995, and that was 25 years ago. A lot has changed since then. Under Oregon law, the city of Portland retains authority to ensure compliance with our comprehensive plan through the issuance of an LUCS. An LUCS is required for a permit renewal where DEQ determines that the permit involves a substantial modification or intensification of permitted activity. Specifically, a LUCS is required where the permitted source or activity relates to the use of additional property or of the physical expansion of the existing property. That was a quote, that last sentence. Zenith's well-documented plans to expand its pipeline system into McCall's property and dock clearly relates to the use of additional property and triggers the need for a new LUCS. Zenith's plans directly contradicts Portland's 2035 comprehensive plan. First, policy 6.48 states the city will limit fossil fuel distribution and storage facilities to those necessary to serve the regional market. Washington, California, and particularly overseas do not serve the regional market. Also, numerous comprehensive plan policies grant the city authority to protect citizens from the many health and safety hazards posed by Zenith, including protecting air quality, watershed health, climate impacts, and reducing fire and seismic risk. And I believe you have a copy of my testimony there with the specific policies I am referring to. We understand that Oregon...
Time is up.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you very much.
Eileen, if you just have a few more finishing comments, if you can keep it to about 15 seconds, we'd appreciate it.
Just that I understand that DEQ has raised concerns about whether their most recent comprehensive has been acknowledged because it's being litigated and it would just be a remarkable usurpation of local authority for DEQ to consider a 1995 permit adequate for today. Thank you. Good. That's it.
Good. Thank you, Eileen, and thank you, Elijah, as well. I just had a few quick comments here. First of all, I want to state for the record, once again, my unequivocal opposition to any expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure or transportation capacity in the city of Portland. I have spoken out very vocally against oil trains that go through the highly sensitive Columbia River Gorge scenic area. I'm equally concerned about oil trains in particular going through our densely populated neighborhoods. That creates an obvious public safety as well as a public health and environmental threat. I really like the thrust of your commentary, both you, Eileen, and Elijah, with regard to the opportunity around the stimulus package to help us move towards a regenerative economy. And that's something that I am highly motivated to do. And I think it's a great opportunity, frankly, as we see some companies laying off people, think Greenbrier, those individuals have skill sets where they could be retrained and potentially come in as part of the green infrastructure, the green planning, the regenerative economy. They have skill sets that could be wisely used in that regard. I also want to thank our colleagues at Multnomah County. As you know, the city and the county have both jointly invested in a fossil fuel risk assessment. That's an important step. And Elijah, I think in particular, that gets to the issue of bonding that you raised, and it's something I am very interested in, and I'm hopeful that that's something that could be implemented here. I think it's wrong that the public takes such a gigantic risk for the profits of a few private sector corporations. I do not think that is an appropriate trade-off for the people that I represent here in the city, and I will continue to fight for the rights for people who live here to live in a safe and environmentally sound and physically healthy environment. So I want to thank you for your participation today and reminding all of us of the importance of this issue. So thank you both for making the effort to be here as part of public testimony. I really appreciate it. And we'll see you again, I hope. In person, maybe next time. We'll see. Next individual, Carla, is item 325. If you could read that item, please.
Request of Joanne Reese to address council regarding Lentz Town Center Development Phase 1 Auditor's Report.
Ms. Reese, are you with us today?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Very well. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Joanne Reese Lucchini. I'm a member of the Lentz Strong Housing Team, but I'm speaking for myself. Activism surrounding Phase 2 Lentz Town Center Development was spearheaded by Lentz Strong, Green Lentz, accomplices in tenants' rights and houseless advocacy, and community groups at the forefront of Portland Mutual Aid. We are not associated with the Neighborhood Association. Lentz Town Center Development, 22 years in the making, yet seemed to have happened overnight, boasted an official at January 2019 Prosper Community Conversation. PDC came and developers prospered, capitalizing on 22 years of historic disinvestment, city-sanctioned blight, deliberate depreciation of the livability of a community. 1 year later, an auditor's report on Lentz development indicated 20 years of investment with minimal evaluation. $200 million later, median family income in Lentz is down 24% from $46,000 to $38,000. Most of the so-called affordable housing in Lentz was at the 60 to 80% MFI, which in Portland is $81,000. Nearly two-thirds of Lentz residents cannot afford their rent due to stagnant wages and falling incomes. 23% of Lentz residents live in poverty, up 7%. Home ownership among people of color dropped from 51% to 41%. Lentz homeowners pay disproportionately higher property taxes. Less than 1% of funds went towards grants and loans to small businesses. Community livability grants, despite being announced, sometimes never get awarded. More than $1 out of five, $41 million, went to administration and staffing. Lentz is a struggling, diverse community of neighbors. In the midst of the coronavirus crisis, faced with fears for health and financial ruin, The mantra, we are resilient, is being replaced by enough is enough. Plans for the Prosper property at 92nd and Herald must be reconsidered to reflect community needs of poor, working poor, and working class people. Our house's neighbors are being swept. Our renting neighbors worry about a catastrophic rent increase. Our home-owning neighbors are being steered by predatory real estate developers. Taxpayer-funded market-rate housing is not a solution. Lentz has been victimized by urban removal as urban renewal. We are one of four neighborhoods most likely to be negatively impacted by residential infill. We demand an invitation to the table, the City Council work session to discuss the auditor's report, and a seat on the Anti-Displacement Committee. Nothing about us without us. Thank you.
Thank you, Joanne. I appreciate it very much. And I just want to note for the benefit of my colleagues that we will receive a presentation, a public presentation on the Lentz audit in the not too distant future. And I do look forward to a public hearing of these issues. I think you've raised some very important points. The housing issue rings very true with me. The Portland Housing Bureau has made investments that have resulted in 476 units recently in Lentz. But as you point out, that's not necessarily very low-income housing. And I also just want to underscore that this council has made a huge commitment to what's called supportive housing. And supportive housing, of course, includes many people who have zero income, people coming in right off the streets. Those are the most chronically homeless. It then connects them to either substance abuse or mental health or job training services, whatever they need to be successful in the community. And your points, I think, underscore the significance of that. And as I mentioned earlier, as we go through our COVID recovery, we're thinking intentionally about households, particularly households with people of color, but we're thinking about all households that are lower income in terms of how to keep them in their housing, how to keep them stable, how to support essential household purchases, while at the same time supporting those small businesses that are making your community so successful. And I want to continue to see the conversations we've had with the Lentz community, you and others. There are few neighborhoods in this community where people have as much resilience and spirit and love for their neighborhood as you do. And I want to thank you for that continued advocacy. So thank you for
that. Am I still on?
You sure are.
Okay. I just wanted to bring to the council's attention that for that presentation in front of City Council, as far as I know, Lentz Strong Housing Team has not been invited, nor has Green Lentz, nor has PTU, Right to Survive, Sisters of the Road, Portland Assembly, or Symbiosis PDX. So I'm just reiterating again that we did most of the legwork for phase two development and that we are watching very carefully who is now claiming credit and using our voices to go and self-promote. Neighborhood Association was very little involved with this. Neither was East Portland Action Plan, et cetera. So I'm just reminding that again. Thank you very much. I appreciate you.
Yeah, and you're right. Nobody's been extended an invitation because we've not set the date yet. And that's going to be dependent upon the audit being completed. But it's my understanding that audit will be completed soon. So nobody's been invited yet, just to be clear. The date has not been set. No invitations have been sent. We will absolutely make sure that we advertise the heck out of it so people know that the conversation is happening. And I'm sure there'll be lots of conversations between now and then. So,
okay, because I just wanted to say one more thing and then just semi-facetiously, is that it took 20 years in order to get that first audit done. So I'm 61. I don't want to be contacted by Ouija board to be given any feedback on the second audit. Thank you.
Thank you. And yeah. I wasn't here 20 years ago. No time on the present. And I will absolutely make sure I keep my Ouija board in the box. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to remind our communication speaker that we have not scheduled RIP yet. And there will be lots of opportunities for people to come. It is not an invitation-only event. It will be a public hearing. And no one is excluded from public hearings that don't act appropriately based on the rules of engagement. I look forward to us continuing that conversation. I absolutely believe we must get RIP done as quickly as possible. I will disagree with Rebecca about, with Joanne about whether or not RIP is a good or a bad thing, but I certainly look forward to the community engaging in the conversation. Thank you, Mayor. And Mayor, by the way, you are on today. I didn't have to say anything on Zenith because you covered everything. So you must have had lots of coffee this morning.
thank you. Indeed, I have. I have indeed. All right, that completes.
Thank you very much.
That completes communications for today. Carla, have any items been pulled off of the consent agenda?
Yes, Mayor, we've had a request for item 330.
Okay, very good. And that is a council request, is that correct?
Correct. Commissioner Hardesty's office.
All right, we'll take that up next, just so I don't forget to take it up. But in the meanwhile, Carla, could you please call the roll on the remainder of the consent agenda?
Hardesty?
Aye.
Udaly?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Wheeler.
All right. The consent agenda is adopted. And if you could read 330, assuming Commissioner Fritz, do we have people from the Water Bureau who can respond to any questions from Commissioner Hardesty?
Yes, and I have a statement as well.
Okay, very good. Carla, could you kindly read 330 for us? Mm-hmm.
Amend intergovernmental agreement with the Regional Water Providers Consortium for a no-cost time extension to provide staffing services.
Colleagues, this is a second reading. We've had a presentation and the opportunity for public commentary. It was on the consent agenda previously, so it was moved to second. And Commissioner Hardesty has some comments. Why don't I start with Commissioner Fritz and then we'll move to Commissioner Hardesty, if that's okay? Commissioner Fritz?
I would hope so. It's my item. So it's quite unusual to have a second reading pulled from consent. And I have not had an opportunity to talk to Commissioner Hardesty about this, but just so that everybody at home knows, the purpose of this ordinance is to authorize a no-cost 5-year extension to the intergovernmental agreement between the City of Portland and the Regional Water Providers Consortium. There are 23 water providers in the consortium. And just to be clear, it's not just the jurisdictions that use Bull Run Water, Portland Water Bureau water. In fact, the City of Newburgh recently joined, despite being outside the metro area. They're in Yamhill County. Commissioner Hardesty, it's similar to the Regional Disaster Preparedness Organization, which I believe you participate in. This is absolutely good government. It's all of us working together on best practices, water conservation, emergency preparedness, and developing water supply planning and resiliency tools, and sharing information like the Water Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act financing. So it's an example of Portland being a good partner to jurisdictions in the region. Everybody pays proportionate to the size of the jurisdiction. And so we pay approximately a third of the dues for the consortium. We provide oversight for the 3.6 full-time equivalent staff, but that's reimbursed, including 30% overhead, which is paid for by the all of the members proportionately. With that, I will be happy to entertain Commissioner Hardesty's questions.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Commissioner Fritz. And my apologies for not asking these questions last week. I was a little focused on another agenda item last week and didn't ask these questions. I'm grateful for your presentation. And my question really has to do with, this is a 5-year extension. I absolutely applaud the consortium. It is the right way to do business. But as we've all been reading, there are unhappy water customers, especially water customers who know their rates will increase based on the activity that we will be undertaking in the near future. And so my concern is always when we have a contract where we pay proportionally is whether our cost goes up if someone drops out of this consortium. And what is the impact on the city's budget if in fact that happens? I know that there are several East County cities that are talking about disengaging from water services with the city of Portland. And so I just, because this is a 5-year agreement, I just wanna understand specifically what the financial risk the city is taking and actually signing an additional 5-year agreement when we don't know whether or not we have cities that will be stepping away from Portland for its water supply.
So with all due respect, that's what I just said was these are not only the customers of the Portland Water Bureau. Lake Oswego, Newburgh, Tualatin. This is a partnership of water providers. It doesn't make any difference whether the Bull Run wholesale customers decide at the end of 2026 that they no longer want to buy Bull Run water. This is about regional providers of water working together to address common goals and values. If you have specific questions, Commissioner, Rebecca Dyson, the lead staff is here, if you'd like to ask any more questions.
Yes, I'm here.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you. I think Commissioner Fritz did a good job of explaining the difference between customers who are negotiating to use our water supply and this consortium's work. That was where I was unclear. Rebecca, if you'd like to add anything, I'm happy. I'm open to that.
Thank you. This is Rebecca Geisen, Managing Director of the Regional Water Providers Consortium. Mayor and commissioners, I guess I would just add that this organization has been together since 1997. And as Commissioner Fritch mentioned, it's most of the water providers from the 3-county area, and it is completely separate from the wholesale relationship that the Bureau has with its wholesalers. Many of the wholesalers are members, but again, the work is completely separate, and all of the members contribute and participate in a very collaborative manner.
That answers my questions. I thank you, Rebecca. I thank you, Commissioner Fritz. Thank you, Mayor.
You got it. Thanks a lot. If there's no further business on this item, Carla, could you please call the roll? It's a second reading.
Hardesty?
I am very appreciative, Commissioner Fritz, and for your staff and actually trying to help me understand the difference between these two water efforts. And I thank you very much, and I vote aye.
You Daly.
Aye.
Fritz.
This is an example of us working with other jurisdictions. Commissioner Hardesty, if you ever have questions, you're welcome to give me a call anytime. Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. We'll move to the regular agenda, please. Item number 332.
Authorize the Bureau of Environmental Services to acquire certain permanent and temporary property rights necessary for construction of the Montevilla North Sewer Repair Project through the exercise of the city's eminent domain authority, project number E10385.
Colleagues, Environmental Services provides sewer and stormwater services to meet the city's current as well as future needs, and of course to protect the public health, property, water quality, and the environment. The Montevilla North Sewer Repair Project in Northeast Portland will repair and replace over 3 miles of pipe that are at risk of failure. While most pipes in the project area are in the public right-of-way, several segments are on private property and require the city to obtain temporary as well as permanent property rights. Here today to give a brief presentation are Eric Dershbeck, Supervisor, and Daniel Tariku, who's the construction project manager. They are both tremendous public employees in the Bureau of Environmental Services. Eric and Daniel, take it away. It looks like you've got your presentation all teed up.
Yes. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm Eric Quick with BES, and we also have Daniel Tariku here with us. Daniel, are you there?
We are. We don't know about Daniel. Oh, there's Daniel.
Daniel, are you good?
I'm here.
All right.
Hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Thank you for the overview, and we will kind of briefly go over and touch on the outreach conducted to date, specific requests for the city to be authorized to give us the ability to offer just compensation to use eminent domain authority. To mention, these are sewers that were installed in 1910, 1960, so they're anywhere from 50 to 100 years old. They vary in depths anywhere from 2 to 26 feet. And these are segments that have been TV inspected and reached the end of their useful service life and have become structurally deficient, high-risk pipes that may fail in less than 5 years. These possess an unacceptable risk to the city and the ratepayers. And while most of the project is located in the right-of-way, we do have several segments that are either in narrow or non-extended easement locations. The objective of the project is to rehab deficient pipes to their integrity. We're looking to use proven methods to eliminate surface roughness and root intrusion and restoring joint integrity. Next, Daniel will go into the overview.
So the solutions toward achieving that objective include open cut excavations, a cured in place, pipelining, CIPP, and pipe bursting for a whole pipe repair, spot repairs for main line extensions or main line sections, use open cut excavation. Work areas have narrow easements from 2 feet to about 5 feet, and at some locations, none. And so disturbances will intrude into private properties where we'll need to shore excavated material, backfill equipment, and access to and from the work location. And as you can see on the sketch from the right here, shows a typical temporary construction footprint, including access and storage. That's the shaded areas. We did specific outreach, including letters, emails, phone calls, and site visits to all properties affected by the easements, and have been having ongoing communication with the property owners over the past couple of years, and more frequently for the past few months. We will restore all affected areas, sites to pre-construction conditions, if not better, and make sure to reach out to the property owners for their feedback.
The cost of acquiring the need of property rights will be determined by an independent appraisal during the eminent domain process. And the schedule, the projected schedule is reflected here. We're hoping to finalize these easements sometime in June, notify and continue to maintain our communication efforts with the residents, and then execute the work sometime end of June through the summer. And we thank you for your time and be happy to field any questions you might have.
Colleagues, any questions? Let's see here. I've got to go to that thing. Commissioner Fritz has a question.
Thank you very much. I'm wondering, have you contacted the property owners to let them know that this was on the agenda?
Yes, we did.
Yes.
And have you heard any concerns from any of them?
Not that I'm aware of. John, do you want to, have you heard any?
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. John Deo with the Bureau of Transportation Right-of-Way Section. I've been working with the BES Public Involvement Group on outreach to the property owners, and we've received no significant concerns. I think all property owners are aware that this work is necessary. they realize it's going to be kind of a temporary inconvenience. Significant concern to date.
Thank you.
Any further questions, colleagues? Carla, is there any public testimony on this item?
No one signed up.
Very good. I'd like to thank our presenters. I'd like to thank Asena Lawrence from Team Fish/Wheeler for her hard work on this item as well. This is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. Next item, 333, please.
Grant a one-year temporary revocable permit to Crown Castle Fiber LLC for wireless communication services in the city.
Colleagues, this is the second reading. We've already heard the presentation and had the opportunity for public testimony. Any further discussion on this item? Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty?
No.
Hugh Daly?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Wheeler?
Yes. Thank you to all for your work on this, particularly the Office for Community Technology. Next up is item 334.
Extend a contract with Motivate International, Inc. and increase the contract value for continued operation of the bike share system in an amount not to exceed $750,000.
Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. Before introducing these items, I'd like to make a motion to accept the substitutes for the ordinance, Exhibit A, and the financial impact statement for item 334. The amendment will read, replace the ordinance Exhibit A and the financial impact statement with the proposed substitutions mentioned in the Tuesday memo. These substitutes change the date, the amended contract ending, the amended contract ends from December 31st to August 1st.
Commissioner Fritz?
Second.
Okay, very good. We have a motion from Commissioner Udaly, a second from Commissioner Fritz. Any
Thank
further
you.
On this? Carla, please call the roll on the substitute.
Wait, I got a question.
Commissioner Hardesty has a question before we call the roll.
Thank you, Mayor. I've been having a hard time getting off of mute for some reason. So we're changing we're extending the date until August rather than December. And is that still?
No, we're actually decreasing it. So it's December 31st, 2020 to August 1st, 2020.
And is there a financial difference between the first one and the second? I haven't seen your amendment.
Do we have staff here that can speak to this?
On board. Catherine, Carlo, could you answer that question for Commissioner Hardesty, please?
Yes, happy to do that. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well. Thank you.
I'm Catherine Chiarlo. I'm with the Bureau of Transportation, managing the Active Transportation and Safety Division. And Commissioner Hardesty, there is no, and Commissioner Udaly, there is no financial impact to the city. There's actually no impact for the extension at all. And we can explain that a little bit further. But there's no different financial impact between December and August.
I thought we were adding $750,000 additional dollars to extend it through December.
What we're actually doing is increasing the authority of the contract. The money comes from the Bike Share Operating Fund, which is completely funded through bike share user trips and sponsorships. So it's not money that we as the city are putting into the system. That's the way the contract's been structured all along. And the extension of the contract and the additional authorization is so that more can be paid, but the city itself isn't paying that per se.
Thank you. And my very last question, I appreciate your responses so far. My very last question are we reducing the time because we anticipate a new RFP going out soon?
Yes, and we can talk about this a little bit more in a little more detail, but we are in the final stages of negotiation of an RFP that's been on the street. We've had two responses and we are in final negotiations with those two respondents and expect to have a contract very soon.
Thank you so much. That answers my questions.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine Charlo, for answering those questions. Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty, for the questions. Carla, please call the roll on the substitute.
Hardesty?
Aye.
Udaly?
Aye.
Fritz?
So I'm hoping we're actually going to have the presentation as well, but aye on the substitute.
Wheeler?
Aye. Substitute's on the table. Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. This contract extension helps ensure that Portlanders will have continuous access to an affordable transportation option. PBOT is currently in contract negotiations for an improved and expanded Biketown system of electric assist bicycles. Bike share provides individuals a way to meet essential transportation needs while observing social distancing requirements. Exercise is important for mental and physical health, especially during times of stress. BikeShare provides an accessible option for Portlanders to exercise and maintain their physical and mental health without going to a gym. And I'm going to turn it back over to Catherine, I think.
Great. Yeah, thank you. So I'm going to try to share my screen here. Hopefully this will work. Did that come through? Great. Okay. Thank you very much, Commissioner Udaly, Mayor Wheeler, and council members. The ordinance in front of you today, as we talked about briefly before, will extend the term and increase the purchasing value of our contract with Motivate International, which is the company that is currently operating our bike share system, Biketown. This amendment is only needed to extend us between now and the end of July, or actually the date is the 1st of August, so that we can complete negotiations with a new operator. And the amendment is really exclusively just to ensure continuous operation as PBOT transitions to the new system. As mentioned earlier, the new system will be an e-bike or electric bike system. We're looking at final negotiations with two providers. Either of those providers would continue under the same rubric that our current provider has been working under, which is no financial input to operate the system or to invest in capital from the city of Portland. All revenues that go in to support the system will be either from user fees or from sponsorship revenues. So we're asking to increase the contract value by $760,000, again, not city contribution, but contract value, and to increase the term or to extend the term to August 1st. We were in front of you about a year ago to do something very similar. Some of you may remember, we had hoped to complete this in the year and we're very, very close, but we just need this last couple of months. As you might imagine, the past couple of months have been a little bit crazy, but we have had successful negotiating conversations with both providers and we're very close to making a selection and getting a contract in place. And I will say also, I will close by saying we're truly excited about what the new contract will allow Portlanders to have in terms of a bike share system. It will be a system that has a much broader citywide reach than our current system, and it will be all electric bikes or e-bikes. We are excited about that. What we've seen in other cities is it really expands the number of people who both can use the system to meet their daily needs in terms of where they're going and where they're located, but also it allows people who may not have a lot of experience bicycling to go farther more efficiently. So again, just concluding, short contract extension to provide continuous service, no impact on the city budget. And I'll turn it over to Steve, my colleague, Steve Hoyt McBeth, to give you a little more information about Biketown and specifically the COVID response work we've been doing.
Thanks, Catherine, and good morning, commissioners and mayor. I wanted to talk about Bytown as part of the COVID response and recovery strategy. And as part of that, I wanted to provide a brief preview of our next presentation to you in a few months, which will be the new operator contract for the dramatically expanded electric bike share system that Catherine just mentioned. We are very proud of our successes of Bytown to date. As the slide shows, we've had 1.3 million trips since 2016, and we're especially proud of how Bytown has provided access and opportunity. Our Bytown for All members, who over 800 community members living on low incomes, including our houseless neighbors, ride Bytown at the highest rate among our membership and at some of the highest rates actually in the country. Next slide, please. Even though we were the 60th U.S. city to launch a bike share system, we still managed to be bike share pioneers. We were the first bike share system in the country to incorporate a program for bike access for people with disabilities. Adaptive Bytown has provided a model for other cities that have followed Portland. Thank you again to Commissioner Udaly for her early advocacy on this, even before she was on council. With Chicago, Detroit, Oakland, Indianapolis, and New York kind of following Portland's model for increasing adaptive bike access throughout the country. Portland was also the first U.S. bike share system to require its operator to meet hiring requirements for people from our historically underserved communities. Next slide, please, Catherine. These successes around ridership and accessibility and opportunity will be especially important as we begin the transition from stay at home. We know that people are going to feel anxiety about this transition, and we believe that will affect people's transportation choices. And from a congestion and a pollution standpoint, the last thing we want is to have everyone who can to start driving everywhere. And especially for our community members without access to a car, we want to provide them more choices. Next slide, please, Catherine. This expanded electric bike system will provide a non-polluting individual means of transport that allows for physical distancing. Because of the assistance of the small electric motor, as Catherine mentioned earlier, Bytown will be even more attractive and accessible to driving alone. And the extension into parts of East Portland this year, with expansions to other parts of the city in 2021 and 2022, will provide this option to more Portlanders and commuters. Next slide, please. And now I would like to talk briefly about Bytown's current COVID-19 response. In this stay-at-home phase, Bytown has a role to play for people who must make essential trips, such as our frontline workers, especially with people for no or lower levels of car access. Bytown allows a travel choice that allows people for physical distancing. And in several cities around the country, especially ones that have a higher transit rate than us, is actually augmenting the transit service. Just as an aside, we were talking to our colleagues with the Chicago Department of Transportation a couple of weeks ago. And during the COVID pandemic, the bike share station now with the highest ridership in Chicago is adjacent to a major metropolitan hospital. On April 6th, we dramatically discounted our ride rates to provide Portlanders who need to complete essential trips with a convenient and affordable transportation choice. Bytown's pay-as-you-go plan is reduced to only 1 cent per minute with a one-time 10-cent sign-up fee for new pay-as-you-go members. We originally reduced these rates for the month of April, and today we are announcing a continuation of this reduction for the month of May as well. And although our ridership is still dramatically below what it was last year at this time, after instituting this highly discounted pricing, we've seen ridership increase over 70%. And we're excited today to announce to you that on Monday, PBOT received a $7,000 emergency response grant from the Better Bike Share Partnership to support this extension into May. That is it for our presentation this morning. We very much appreciate your time and are here for any questions or questions you may have about our cleaning protocols or anything else. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Steve. Commissioner Fritz, then Commissioner Hardesty.
Yeah, Steve, if you could just tell us about how are the bikes cleaned between uses, and then I have another question after that.
Thank you, Commissioner Fritz. So we have, with our operator Motivated, instituted two enhancements of the cleaning protocols for Biketown. So what we are doing, what our operator Motivated is doing now is every time bikes are serviced at a station, so our rebalancing crew, our crews go to stations to do a lot of different things. One is to make sure that there are bikes at the station, or make sure there are open spaces to park at the station, to swap batteries of bikes, or to do spot inspections of bikes for maintenance issues that users have flagged from using the system. So when any of these things happen at a station, all of the bikes at that station are then cleaned. When bikes are brought into the depot for service, all of those bikes are cleaned. In the vans, all high contact surfaces are cleaned at the beginning of shifts. The staff are wearing gloves when they're out there, and they're also recommended to wear face coverings as well during that. So that is what I have on the protocols.
Is there a new instruction to riders to wear gloves as well?
Thank you very much for bringing that up, Commissioner. I forgot to bring that up. So we have when you check out a bike at a station or end a bike trip at a station, you receive via the Biketown app, you receive a push notification on your phone, which encourages you to wash your hands and to take other actions to make sure you're safe. It's a very short message.
I'm not sure that actually helps, because then you're going to touch your phone with your hands that you haven't washed yet. But anyway, I appreciate the thought. I want to go back to what has always been my concern about these bikes, which is people not wearing helmets, including some of the photographs that you have in your presentation. And I've been assured since the beginning of this program that because the bikes are clunky and slow, that there's less of a concern with when people have crashes. I am concerned about the e-bikes, which presumably go faster. Have you made any progress in being able to provide helmets on demand?
Thank you for that question, Commissioner Fritz. I'll get to your question, but I just do want to make sure that we share that from the beginning, our Biketown for All members all receive a free helmet as part of the program. So for folks who may have financial barriers to securing a helmet, provide them a helmet with the system. We have continued to have challenges in trying to find a solution for on-demand helmet provisions. We're pursuing such a solution with a vendor who then went out of business, and we are continuing to just try to figure out ways that we can make helmets more accessible. And at this point, I don't have a solution that we've been able to find. I was talking actually just last month with the former provider in Seattle who had made, I think, the most headroads into this, and to talk to him about his ideas. But we are still challenged by the on-demand nature of providing helmets and the complexities of providing clean helmets to people between rides.
Yeah, I know it's been a challenge, and I appreciate you continuing to work on it. I would hope that in the contract that you're working to negotiate, there will be an indemnification of the city, that if somebody does have a crash, that we are not liable for that, any injuries that are. And I'm seeing Catherine Charlo nodding, so that I'm glad that you got on that. My final question and or concern is, again, regarding the speed of these bikes. When I'm walking in my area, I'm having a particular difficulty with cyclists who, by nature of the bike lane being next to the curb, the cyclist is right next to the curb, and in some places there isn't a 6-foot sidewalk. In many places there isn't a 6-foot sidewalk, and particularly when they come up from behind, there's no opportunity for me to leap into the bushes or try to climb the wall that's next to it. So I'm just wondering if there can be some kind of a an education campaign as we start to get out to remind cyclists that pedestrians are vulnerable and not able to move as quickly. That's more of a request than a question. Thank you.
I think it's an excellent idea, Commissioner Fritz. Thank you very much. And I think if I understand your framing is not just for bike share, but just in general in terms of all people bicycling, whether on their private bike or not. And thank you very much.
Yeah, and in particular, encouraging all cyclists to wear masks, because that would protect adjacent pedestrians as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Commissioner Fritz, thank you. Just pulling together a couple of those ideas, we will be doing extensive outreach as we start to implement the system, the new system, both before and during the time that the bikes get on the ground. And the question about masks will absolutely be included in our outreach materials, as will the question about spacing, appropriate spacing, because in all likelihood, we'll still find ourselves in a physical distancing environment. Also, this meshes well with Commissioner Udaly's announcement yesterday of trying to create some additional space on greenways throughout the city and potentially even in some busier street locations, try to create separation between bicyclists and pedestrians. So that will certainly support the solutions to the problem you identify, but again, there's no substitute for just as we do the outreach, reminding people that they need to be courteous to the more vulnerable users who are pedestrians. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you both, Stephen and Catherine, for that presentation. Commissioner Fritz asked several of my questions, so I'll just go to the ones that she didn't get to in her questioning process. So the new electric bikes, as you may know, there are no bike town locations in East Portland. And so for this to be a citywide program of electric bikes, how will folks in East Portland have access to them?
Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty. Catherine, did you want me to take that or would you prefer to?
Please.
Okay, thank you. So as part of our request for proposal, one of the things that we required within the first phase of the new system was to include East Portland as part of that service area. So as part of this new system that we will launch in 2020, East Portland, not the entirety of East Portland, but a significant part of East Portland will be included in that service area in 2020 with further extensions in the following years. So that was something that was very important to us and something that we, when we presented to council last year, that we had stated that we were going to do, and that was part of the RFP. And so that is a required component of the system, which will actually make our system one of the largest service areas in the country just because of the kind of the large landmass of Portland.
And so does that mean that there will be electric charging stations in East Portland? Or does that mean I'll have to take my dead bike downtown to get it refueled?
So the way that the bikes will mainly be recharged during the first phase is by the operator, similar to what we actually do now, even though the battery that's on the bike town bike now is purely for charging the computer that's in the bike. Most of those bikes will be swapped. There will be, depending upon which operator we choose, there will be a small number of bike charging stations or none in the first phase. But they will, so the bikes will be charged pretty much the same way system wide in that first phase. So, and we actually, as part of the service levels that we're requiring and negotiating with our providers, we're actually requiring a higher service level in East Portland than we are in the rest of the city. So it's just something that we've really tried to make sure that we paid close attention to the needs of our community members in East Portland.
Maybe I can add, one of the fascinating things about talking with these high-tech companies is that they actually have centralized ways to understand where the battery levels, the charge levels are from a central dashboard. And so they are taking responsibility as the system operator in the field.
Thank you. It sounds like it's moving forward. I share the same concerns about helmets that we tell people they're supposed to wear, but we don't make them wear them. And I am hopeful that the cost, even though the cost has gone down because of the pandemic and a lack of people's mobility, I hope that the cost will also continue to be low initially so that people can get used to this new mode of transportation so that we can actually create a new generation of bike users, especially in East Portland. So thank you so much. I love the preview of the conversation we're going to have later, and I always enjoy the Bike Town presentation. So thank you very much. Appreciate the work.
Thank you, Commissioner Hardison.
Commissioner Udaly, you have your hand raised.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. Hi, Steve and Catherine. Thanks for being here today. And thanks for the presentation. I'm happy to see the accommodations we're making in light of the current crisis. And I have a couple questions. State and local laws require that e-scooter riders wear a helmet, although we know that many don't. What does the law say about e-bikes?
Commissioner, I am afraid that that is an obvious thing that I forgot to prep myself on. I don't believe there.
I know the answer for that.
But I want to make sure. So I would prefer to get back to you, Commissioner, and copy the rest of the offices to make sure I'm providing accurate information.
Sounds like Catherine has an answer.
Yeah, Catherine.
The answer that I will give you today is that bikes are not, bicycle riders are not required by state law to wear helmets unless they're 16 and under. And scooters are defined in state law, and they have a separate and different requirement, helmet requirement. The only reason that might come into play is if there was a case that tried to define an electric assist bike as a scooter. We don't think that's likely to happen, but that could never happen. Right now, the way the statutes look, they're bikes, the helmet requirement is not there.
That was my recollection, but I wanted to make sure. And how fast will the e-bikes go that are part of the E-Town program?
We have the choice to calibrate that, but right now the plan was 20 mile an hour maximum.
So 5 miles an hour faster than the scooters?
That's correct. That would be correct, yes.
I certainly share my colleagues' concerns about helmets. Considering what's going on right now, I don't see a way that we could reasonably provide them, because I doubt if people would feel comfortable using a helmet that someone else may have recently used. I started carrying a helmet around with me when I was riding scooters downtown every now and then. I keep one at the office or I'd have one in my bag. I think for now, we just really need to encourage users to take responsibility for that. You know you're going to ride a bike, bring your helmet. Also, wear a mask and bring some hand sanitizer as well. I think, you know, everyone has to do their part to keep themselves and each other safe. So I appreciate the precautions, but don't want to leave the public thinking that no further action is needed on their part.
Thank you.
We will
do that in the outreach efforts, both with system launch and ongoing.
Yeah. And in all my messaging, about the slow streets, safe streets, I have been encouraging people to wear masks, even though, again, we don't require it. We know it's the best practice, and especially people who are moving quickly and breathing heavily, whether they're running or riding a bike, they should be wearing a mask, which doesn't sound like fun at all to me. So I've been taking leisurely strolls with my mask on. Thank you.
And Commissioner Udaly, I just was checking through the magic of the internet to clarify what I think Catherine had suggested, is that you are not required to wear a helmet if you're over 16 years of age, if you're riding an electric bike as well.
Oh, good. Thank you.
But it's a really good idea.
Yes.
All right, good. Any other questions on this item? It's an emergency ordinance. Seeing none, Carla, please call the roll.
And also, we did not have anybody sign up to
testify. Oh, yeah. Thank you for reminding me to ask. Do we have anybody signed up for public testimony?
We do not.
Thank you, Carla.
You're please welcome. Call the roll. Hardesty.
I am so thrilled with the work that you've done on the bike program. It is clear that you've been listening to the city council. It is clear that you are trying to ensure that we have equitable distribution of bikes throughout the city of Portland. I'm really proud of the work that you've done, and I look forward to maybe riding an electric bike in my own neighborhood sometime this year. Not one word. Maybe it's next year, but we'll see. I vote aye.
You, Daly.
Well, thanks again, Stephen and Catherine. I'm very pleased with this, and I'm excited to learn more about the new contract, and especially appreciative of you continuing to advance our equity goals. As Steve mentioned, I called out the city for not having an adaptive option for people with disabilities, and we managed to create something, although it's not equitable, I'll put it that way. It's a start, and if I've learned anything in this job, you have to start somewhere. So thank you again, I vote aye.
Fritz.
I appreciate all the good work from staff on this over many years and renegotiating the contract. Thank you, Commissioner Udaly, for noting that people should be wearing helmets and masks and gloves when they are cycling. And that's for all kinds of cyclists to do the same as pedestrians to help keep everybody safe. Aye.
Wheeler.
I'm excited about this. This is something I'm enthusiastically supportive of. I would go so far as to say this is a game changer. Some of you remember I had minor surgery last year and I was not able to ride my usual bike. So I started riding one of the bike share electric bikes that's provided through the city fleet program. And I immediately fell in love with it. The reason I call it a game changer is it provides, I think, mobility in two really interesting ways. Somebody here said that it would inspire the next generation of bike riders. I actually think it's not only going to inspire the next generation of bike riders, I actually think it transforms transportation in a way that all generations will benefit. And in fact, I think you'll see a lot of older adults who would not rent a bike share, a typical manual bike, who will in fact enthusiastically embrace e-bikes. And maybe people with minor disabilities, people with knee problems or hip problems or whatever else will find that, hey, while they may not be able to trudge up a bit of a hill on a regular bike, they will actually find that an e-bike can be literally effortless in terms of moving around. And to Commissioner Hardesty's great questions around East Portland and access to this new opportunity, I actually think East Portland could be the big beneficiary from a transformation towards e-bikes because you have to go longer distances. And I really enjoyed the fact that now I can get on an e-bike at City Hall and I can go all the way to East Portland on an e-bike, on a charge, and get all the way back. And I can wear a suit and not even break a sweat. So it's really a fantastic alternative. It certainly meets our climate action goals. It addresses our transportation goals in a meaningful way. And the big hang up for me has just been the cost. I have the benefit of using a city issued bike, but if you go to any bike store in Portland and you look at the cost of buying your own e-bike, it is prohibitive for most people in this city. They are still thousands of dollars, even for a basic e-bike. So the fact that we're now going to have this as part of our short-term rental fleet in the city of Portland, for me, it's just truly exciting. And I appreciate the Transportation Commissioner, Commissioner Udaly, and the transportation team at PBOT and our private sector partners who are engaged in this. I predict this is going to take off and it's just going to keep on going. This I predict will be the game changer that we've been looking for in the bike share program. And so I enthusiastically vote aye. Thank you for your hard work, all. Next item, also from Commissioner Udaly, is the item number 335.
Authorize a contract with the lowest responsible bidder for the downtown I-405 pedestrian safety and operational improvements project for an estimated $3,183,401.
Before I turn this over to Commissioner Udaly, I just have to say we should hire a poet, because this item, the way it's written here, sounds utterly boring, but I know it's the opposite of boring. So Commissioner Udaly, pump some passion into life into this otherwise bureaucratic sounding item, because I know this is a big deal. Go for it.
Well, thank you, Mayor. PBOT continues to work toward improving safety for Portlanders regardless of how they travel. The downtown I-405 pedestrian safety and operational improvements project is a mouthful, but it also brings needed safety investments to West Burnside, one of Portland's high crash corridors. By investing in modern signals, ADA curb ramps, and safer crossings, this project will make walking, rolling, biking, and driving safer on Burnside and Cooch, adjacent to I-405, while also helping to stitch the neighborhood back together.
Now, see, that's good. Stitch the neighborhood back together is so much better. That's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. And I'll just add, I lived on 19th and Hoyt for 18 years, and my shop was down on 9th and Oak. And so I have walked and biked through this area who knows how many times. And I'm just excited for these improvements because it's pretty treacherous.
Awesome. Is there a presentation?
Do we have staff here to talk about this item?
Let's say Gabriel's here. Mr. Graff.
Gabriel Graff, take it away.
Thank you for that kind introduction, Mayor and Commissioners. Appreciate it. Yeah, I'm just here to ask for permission to bid to the lowest responsible bidder this downtown I-405 pedestrian safety and operational improvements project. And I have just a handful of slides, which I believe... someone was in advance for me. Yeah, thank you so much.
They're coming.
There we go. Next slide, please. So this project, its origins and location, it was first conceived in the Pearl District Access and Circulation Plan adopted by City Council in 2012. The concept from that plan is shown here. As you can see, it reconfigures the I-405 and the Cooch Burnside interchange with the goal of making it safer and easier to cross 405 on foot and to simplify the operations for people driving and cycling through the corridor. Next slide. The project is funded by a federal fund through an ODOT grant through their ENHANCE program and matched by the Portland Bureau of Transportation with TSDCs and some GTR gas tax. And next slide. And then finally, here's the diagram of what the sort of final project will look like from above. So the traffic signals at these locations, those little traffic light icons, will all be upgraded to modern, safer signals. All the curb ramps will be made accessible to current standard. Northwest 16th will be simplified so that you can continue driving southbound on 16th directly to Burnside to a new signal to access it. New sidewalk, street lights, and street trees will be planted, and bike access across Burnside will be improved. There is a 15% DBE goal set by the state of Oregon for the federal funds. And I'm happy to answer any questions about that.
Very good. I have a question. I'll start off. And can you keep it on that slide, please, for just a moment? Can you, unfortunately, the list is right in front of me. Hang on, I'm going to close that for a minute. Can you explain to me what's going on 16th if I am heading north in the two-way cycle track? Explain to me what is going on there with regard to how I, so it looks like I'm cutting across the pedestrian crossing at 16th and Burnside to then go north in the two-way cycle track. But how am I separated from the southbound cycle traffic during that transition across the pedestrian intersection? That's confusing to me on paper. Can you unwind that for me? If I'm going north in the two-way cycle track on Southwest 16th, and I'm crossing Burnside to Northwest 16th to go northbound in the two-way cycle track, tell me what I'm doing there.
Sure, absolutely, Mayor. Essentially, if you are, say you're riding on one of those new fancy Bike Town e-bikes we're all excited about, as you reach the intersection of Burnside, the traffic signal there will be, provide an indication to troops cross at a safe time when there's not cross traffic on Burnside. And you'll go in what we call a contraflow bike lane that will be separated from the oncoming traffic or the southbound 16th traffic with a concrete separator or curb.
So the concrete separator, and I'm sorry to dwell on what seems like such a small thing, but the truth is if you have a green light on Southwest 16th heading north, you could be going at a fairly fast rate of speed through that intersection, particularly for people who maybe are trying to push the yellow a little bit on that. How are you going to make that quick decision to go right through the pedestrian crossing and then know to immediately turn left without interacting with somebody on a bike coming southbound through the same intersection while at the same time trying to not hit pedestrians crossing in that crosswalk? Do we have any similar crossings in the city of Portland that you could point me to so I could understand how that's going to work?
Mayor, I'm sorry, I can't think of one that springs to mind. It is a unique crossing, but I think so it's like, you know, it's an offset intersection, and also as a driver you can't go through on it, right? They're opposing, 16th is opposing when it approaches Burnside. The way the signal will operate at that sort of 16th and Burnside location will be for drivers, northbound and southbound, Burnside would stop. No one on Burnside would be moving, and then the lefts would go. So people would be able to make lefts, the rights would go, people would be able to make rights. And when the lefts are going, there's no conflict for people walking or biking across the street.
Okay, so the walkers are going to go separately from the bikers, is that correct?
The walkers will have a leading interval, so they'll have a head start.
Okay, because I noticed you've specifically designed that as an ADA accessible crossing, and I'm not trying to put too fine a point on this, but I just want to acknowledge that bicyclists, once they get around the corner, will have to make a decision to do an S-turn through an ADA compliant crosswalk and then make sure they don't end up going into oncoming traffic on Northwest 16th. They have to thread that needle and go into the northbound bike lane, which is a two-way bike lane. So I just want to flag that as something that I know your team can solve that engineering and safety issue, but I just want to flag it as something that struck me as a potential conflict zone if it's not done really, really thoughtfully. So that's not really a question. I'm just saying flag it. Let's make sure we're really thoughtful about it. And it sounds like you're already working towards that.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. And I have to get back to the participants list. Commissioner Hardesty has her hand up.
Thank you, Mayor. My question was really similar to yours. This is probably one of the worst convoluted intersections in downtown Portland. And it's really difficult for any mode of traffic to get through. And so I guess my question is, very similar to the mayor's, is whether or not this is going to be a huge safety improvement for all modes of transit. Walking this area is just taking your life into your hands if you're trying to walk even down Burnside. And so I guess that's my bigger question, is how is this going to improve pedestrian safety in this part of the city?
Thank you, Commissioner. So there's a couple of elements that are specifically, I think the primary goal of the project is really the safety of pedestrians and the and better facilitating the crossing of for people trying to get across 405. You can, as you sort of note, you can really see how this local street network, was really kind of torn apart by 405 being constructed here. So the on Cooch, at Cooch at 16th, today, if you are in a car driving southbound on 16th, there's a, what we call a slip lane that allows you to go from 16th to 15th. And in this diagram here, the sort of a dark gray plaza with some trees in the middle, we're closing down that slip lane. So what it means is there's fewer times you have to cross a crosswalk and be exposed to unsignalized vehicular traffic to get across. Now those, you can walk in a straight line, the crossings are fully accessible, and there's fewer of them. And a similar similar approach is being taken on Burnside. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you.
Can I ask one more question?
My eyes are a little bad. Trying to look at this little tiny map and see all the crossings is a little challenging, but I think that it did answer it. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Gabriel, can I ask one more question? You answered this, but I want to make sure I understood the answer to your question. So so the crosswalk at 16th and Burnside will only be signalized for bikers or for pedestrians at any given time. It will never be signalized for both. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, and I can confirm this and get back to you, is that the signal operation, that signal, the people walking will have what we call a leading interval. So the and we do this, this is a common practice where the pedestrian, the walk light for people crossing the street will go before other people do. So the pedestrian gets a head start out into the intersection.
Okay, I'd really like you to confirm that. And the paint's not gonna hit the pavement for quite a while, and this is even a first reading. But I'd like further clarification on that, or maybe you could just report it to the, Commissioner Udaly is our transportation commissioner. I'm really leery about just the idea of crossing an ADA pedestrian crossing and people having to make a quick decision about who has right of way and whatnot. Something just doesn't feel right to me about that. So if you could dig a little deeper on that, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely, we can get back to you.
All right, thanks a lot. Any other questions, Commissioner Hardesty? No, she couldn't possibly, I see a chair. So she probably just left her hand up, would be my guess on that. Any further comments on this before we move it? Very good. Item 335 is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. Thank you, Commissioner Daly, and thank you, Gabriel, for a good presentation. Looks great.
Pleasure to be here virtually with you all. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll see you next time. Carly, item 336. I should have asked, was there any public testimony on 335?
No one registered, Mayor.
Alrighty, good. And we'll still take public testimony on that through email if people want to give us their thoughts, having heard the conversation. Item 336, please.
Authorize intergovernmental and grant agreements in support of the Water Leak Repair Assistance Program for income-qualified Portlanders in an amount not to exceed $1,250,000 over a period of 5 years.
Colleagues and or chairs, this is a second reading of a non-emergency ordinance. We've already heard the presentation and had the opportunity for public testimony. Is there any further discussion on this item? Seeing none, Carla, please call the roll.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Udaly.
Aye.
Well, thanks to Sarah Santner for the presentation and for all your work on this program. As I mentioned last week, Mayor Wheeler and I are working with Environmental Services and the Water Bureau to expand our assistance to customers at this time. But this is a very good first step, and we'll be back with more as soon as we can. Aye.
Wheeler.
I vote aye. The ordinance is adopted. The ordinance passes. Thank you all for that. And Carla, I believe that completes our agenda. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mayor.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you soon. We are adjourned.
Well done.
Thank you.